Hello, this is Auntie Bee's Knees with your business report for the week of March 10th, 2003. We start off this week with some updates on last week's stories as icky news continues to pour in about the machinations among the British arms and nuclear industries and the governments of both the UK and the US. Britain's Ministry of Defence refuses to publish the names of its employees or secondees, and the Ministry, or MOD as it's known, is regarded as the most secretive of all British government departments. But a parliamentary question tabled last year by Liberal Democrat trade and industry spokesman Vince Cable managed to reveal that over the past 5 years, the MOD has hired 46 employees from private companies. Of those 46, 13 came from BAE Systems, the UK's largest arms manufacturer. Putting BAE dominance into perspective, Marconi is the next most prominent private firm with just 3 secondees. The story adds credence to allegations that BAE's close relationship to the UK government's military department brings the department's defence procurement practices into question. In fact, some BAE staff work with the MOD to promote arms sales abroad and to finesse ongoing projects. More alarmingly, of the 13 former BAE Systems employees in the ministry, 7 play a role in shaping government defence policy. Other firms featured in the UK Ministry of Defence's hiring pool include Rolls-Royce and British Nuclear Fuels. The UK's state-owned nuclear energy provider, British Nuclear Fuels, or BNFL, also owns Westinghouse in the US. 3 years ago, a large number of internal documents were leaked from BNFL, revealing that the company's public relations department was involved in crafting a series of secretive memos advising the UK's Department of Trade and Industry on how to deal with anti-nuke ministers and MPs. Documents also revealed that the company had buried safety information about the operation of nuclear waste trains with the knowledge of the Department of Trade and Industry, which, I must add, technically owns the corporation. In 1997, an official reply to Irish MP Mildred Fox, who had written to Prime Minister Tony Blair calling for Ireland's Sellafield reactor site to be closed down, was secretly scripted from BNFL publicity. Sellafield, home of a 1957 reactor fire, lies on the Irish seacoast across the water from England's Lake District. In an area of just 1 mile by a mile and a half, the site hosts lethal legacies of nuclear weapons material production and commercial nuclear fuel reprocessing residue. The site's 4 reactors are operating at 25 years beyond their original lifespan and until recently produced plutonium for the UK nuclear weapons industry. These reactors have been discharging radioactive waste into the Irish Sea for as many years as the site has been a target of shutdown campaigns. The UK government's response to Fox, from then Energy Minister at the Department of Trade and Industry John Battle, informed her that her fears about Sellafield were unfounded. To bolster this argument, the letter lifted a paragraph from BNFL publicity, the very company Fox was criticizing. Correlative documents revealed that BNFL had suggested to the department that because Fox was an independent MP, her reply, quote, should come from a more junior minister than the Trade and Industry Secretary. BNFL also sent the department a draft reply, which was included almost verbatim in the letter eventually sent to Ms. Fox under the name of John Battle. Other memos distributed to government officials by BNFL's Public Relations Department advised government officials on how to deal with backbench Labour MPs who complained about the company's nuclear activities. The same year, BNFL staff buried information about the dangers of trains carrying radioactive waste hundreds of miles across Britain. Officials at the Department of Trade and Industry were told by BNFL only that information about the speed of these trains was being hidden from the public. Another memo suggested that the Department of Trade and Industry was encouraging BNFL to keep quiet about its failures in complying with reporting requirements on accidents and other safety issues. In 1999, 8 plutonium uranium oxide fuel assemblies manufactured by BNFL for a nuclear power plant in Japan were found to have safety data which had been deliberately falsified. Even after this was discovered, it was a year before the company could be coerced to take back the fuel, and a British-flagged vessel did not arrive to collect the cargo until last summer. The UK government's position in this scandal was that safety had not been undermined by the deliberate falsification of safety data. Said Eileen Miyoko-Smith, director of Japan's Green Action Environmental Group, quote, "It is shocking that this company and the British government do not consider fuel with falsified quality control data to be unsafe," unquote. BNFL also has its fingers in the American and North Korean nuclear pies. Last week, the Boston Globe reported that the Bush administration has neither suspended nor revoked the authority of BNFL subsidiary Westinghouse to share nuclear technology data with North Korea. The news comes after North Korea has admitted it is in violation of a nuclear nonproliferation agreement signed with the U.S. in 1994. U.S. Department of Energy documents released to Democratic Representative Edward Markey indicate that the Bush administration rejected a chance to overcome overturn the Westinghouse deal in May of 2001, when the Department of Energy instead extended for 5 more years the authority of Westinghouse to transfer nuclear technology to North Korea. Markey, co-chairman of a congressional non-proliferation task force and a member of the Homeland Security Committee, prodded the Bush administration to provide specific information on what nuclear technology transfers had been approved in a series of letters and committee meetings. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, responding on March 4th to a letter Markey had sent October 22nd, said that more than 3,000 nuclear-related documents have been reviewed by the department and 300 have been transferred to North Korea, including safety analysis, training, quality assurance, and construction documents. The Bush administration has refused to call North Korea's nuclear program a crisis and has also refused to meet with North Korean diplomats, arguing that doing so would reward the government's bad behavior. Congressional Democrats have been increasingly critical of Bush's approach to North Korea, with many insisting that the threat posed by a nuclear-armed North Korea is far greater than any posed by Iraq. Yet, the Bush administration continues to allow a nuclear energy company, indirectly owned by the British government, to support North Korea's nuclear program with American information. The evidence of BNFL's relationship to both the UK and US governments might help to explain why UK Prime Minister Tony Blair has been one of Bush's staunchest allies. While we're on the subject of companies in bed with government warmongers, did you know that the company which makes Tide, Crest, and Pampers is also one of the top contractors for the Pentagon? One of Auntie Beesney's top 10 naughtiest corporations of 2002 for oh so many reasons, Procter & Gamble has also had more than half a billion US dollars worth of business from the Pentagon in the last 2 years. P&G annually makes the Pentagon's top 100 contractors list. Activists are calling for a boycott of all Procter & Gamble products, including Always sanitary napkins and Tampax tampons, Aussie Herbal Essences, Pantene, Vidal Sassoon, and Head & Shoulders hair products, Hugo Boss and Helmut Lang clothing, Bounce & Downy fabric softeners, Bounty paper towels, Kamei Zest & Ivory soap, Charmin toilet paper, Cheer & Tide detergents, CoverGirl & Max Factor makeup, Crest toothpaste, Folgers coffee, Iams pet food, Noxzema, NyQuil, Vicks, Scope, Oil of Olay, Old Spice, Swiffer, Sunny Delight, and Pringles, among other products. It's a daunting task given the many tentacles of Procter & Gamble's business, but if you'd like to join the boycott, also consider writing to Procter & Gamble CEOs in Canada and the U.S. to explain that you are refusing to buy products from a company that profits from the war machine. As an aside, it turns out that a couple of other companies from Auntie Beesney's top 10 list of naughty corporations of 2002 are in business with the Pentagon, namely ExxonMobil and Tyson Foods. Some economists are arguing that, among its countless economic blunders, the current U.S. administration could single-handedly lead to the dismantling of the World Trade Organization, or WTO. But that shouldn't matter too much, as the U.S. government is working fast to approve a slew of unilateral and multilateral free trade agreements in Latin America and Asia. The WTO's current round of talks, launched in Doha, Qatar in 2001, was intended to be a, quote, development round, end quote. At that meeting, members agreed to declarations promising poorer nations access to generic drugs and an elimination of agriculture subsidies in Europe, Japan, and North America. But at recent talks in Geneva, the U.S. flatly reneged on both counts. It's an unfortunate fact that last fall's Republican victory in the U.S. congressional elections was made with the help of $60 million worth of donations from the pharmaceutical lobby and $35 million from agribusiness. These contributions now seem to be paying off in U.S. filibustering at the WTO. If the WTO falls apart, as some economists are speculating might happen, nations will have to resolve trade disputes unilaterally or through regional pacts, a process that would likely benefit only the richest nations. Already with NAFTA on the books, CAFTA in the works, and the FTAA still on the shelf, the U.S. appears to be preparing for this possibility. Last week, all but one of 31 advisory committees reviewing U.S. free trade agreements with Chile and Singapore recommended congressional approval. Even the Trade and Environment Policy Advisory Committee recommended approval of the deals, though some members dissented over investment and dispute resolution. Only the Labor Panel rejected the agreements on the grounds that they will threaten American jobs. Said the Labor Panel, quote, "These agreements repeat the same mistakes of the North American Free Trade Agreement and are likely to lead to the same deteriorating trade balances, lost jobs, trampled rights, and inadequate economic development that NAFTA has created," end quote. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney said, quote, "The only winners in today's unbalanced global economy are the multinational corporations that rack up big profits as they move production from country to country. The American labor movement strongly urges Congress to reject the Chile and Singapore agreements," end quote. The Bush administration says the overwhelmingly favorable views from 700 individuals who served on the advisory panels should send a strong message to Congress that the agreements deserve to be approved. Trade promotion authority passed by Congress last year means that both the Senate and Congress will have to deal with the agreements under fast-track rules that allow no amendments to be offered. The deals would remove virtually all barriers to trade between the U.S. and Singapore, as well as Chile. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zolik says the texts of the agreements will be made available to the public within the next 2 months, after government lawyers ensure they contain no errors. And lastly, Canada's Talisman Energy has finally completed the deal to sell its controversial oil interests in Sudan. The 25% stake in the Greater Nile Oil Production and Pipeline Project is being sold for more than $1 billion to a subsidiary of India's National Oil Company. The stake had become a political headache for Talisman, as critics, including human rights groups and churches, complained that revenues from the project were helping to finance Sudan's bloody civil war, which began in 1983 and has left more than 2 million people dead and many more displaced. Talisman continues to maintain that its presence in Sudan promoted peace and development, though evidence shows a direct correlation between the oil industry and the Sudanese government's purchase of arms, as well as Sudanese military involvement in securing oil-producing land. Talisman's president and CEO Jim Buckey has also said that the company could return to Sudan in the event of a peace agreement. Sale of the stake, which was originally announced last October, dragged on more than 2 months after Talisman's original deadline for closing the deal. Energy analysts speculated that Talisman's stock, which rose only about 6% after the sale was announced, was being discounted over doubts that the sale would ever be even completed. Talisman spent more than $300 million last year to buy back shares in an attempt to boost their value. The company plans to use profits from the sale of the Sudanese stake to buy back more shares and to exploit interests in Canada's natural gas reserves and North Sea oil. The company is also anticipating production from new projects in Malaysia, Vietnam, and Algeria. That's a wrap for this week's Business Report. Signing off, this is Auntie Bee's Knees reminding you to put your money where your mouth is and invest ethically.